You're listening to ABC Radio National's MP3 and podcast of The Law Report. Find out more, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello and welcome to The Law Report. I'm Damien Carrick. This evening, the many ethical and legal debates surrounding the tragic case of Maria Korp, the woman who died last Friday after a decision by the Victorian Public Advocate to withdraw her feeding tubes. Maria had been in a coma since February when she was strangled in her garage, locked in the boot of a car and left for dead. Since then, her husband Joe Korp and his lover Tanya Herman have both been charged with attempted murder. Tanya, who carried out the attack, has pleaded guilty and is now serving a lengthy prison term. Joe Korp is pleading not guilty. He strenuously denies Herman's claims that he told her to kill Maria. Jim Robinson was Maria Korp's lawyer, and he continues to act for her daughter, Laura de Guaz. He explains the injuries Maria suffered in the attack, which left her in a coma.
To put it very briefly, she had hypoxic brain injury, which meant that her brain had shut down to a large extent because of the lack of oxygen during the strangling. As a result of having lain in the boot of the car for 5 days, she also had a pressure sore at the base of her spine, which in fact never healed during the whole of the time she was in hospital.
Now, since last February, you've been involved in a number of legal steps relating to Maria Korp. Tell me, I guess the first one was the administration order.
That's correct. In Victoria, and I'm not sure how it's reflected in other states, but in Victoria we have a piece of legislation called the Guardianship and Administration Act, and anybody who lacks mental capacity for whatever reason can have appointed to look after them to their financial affairs and or their medical affairs, someone under the Act. The person who needs someone appointed for them is called the represented person. And an administrator can be appointed to look after their financial affairs, and a guardian can be appointed to look after their medical treatment. Now, in this case, in March, we decided that Laura should apply to be appointed the administrator of her mother's estate, and that hearing came before VCAT on the 29th of March. At that time, the appointment of being a guardian was also offered, but we declined it because we didn't want the responsibility for those sorts of decisions.
And your client didn't want that responsibility herself?
Well, she didn't want to have to make the sort of decision that Julian Gardner had to make.
The decision you're referring to there was a decision of the Victorian Public Advocate, Julian Gardner, to approve the stopping of the supplying of food and water to the unconscious Maria. What is her family's view? What is Laura's view?
This is a legal program, and I don't think we'd want to go into individuals' attitudes to these things. The decision was made by the Public Advocate, and he was the appropriate person to make the decision.
Lawyer Jim Robinson, a partner with Best Hooper in Melbourne. And as you heard, that decision was made by the Victorian Public Advocate Julian Gardner. Julian says he and many others did a lot of soul searching before agreeing to withdraw sustenance.
I was appointed by the Victorian Civil and Administrative Tribunal as her guardian following an application by a social worker at the hospital. I was given powers to make decisions about her medical treatment, her accommodation and access to her by persons.
Now, what has been or what was the medical condition of Maria Korp post the events of February?
Well, it varied over the time, but she was always, of course, not conscious, not communicative, insensate, with no cognitive capacity. She gradually declined over that time. She had periods where her condition was stabilised and then would go downhill again. Towards the end, she was in a terminal condition, not in a distant sense, but in the short term. She was not absorbing the food that she was being given artificially via a PEG tube. She was losing weight and wasting away, further muscle contracting, and it was the view of the doctors that she was in a dying state.
Now, Maria Korp died last Friday morning following a decision by you to cease the provision of food and water via a tube. What factors contributed to you making that decision?
Well, technically it was not my decision, it was a decision of the clinical team. As guardian, I wasn't really required to make a decision other than to say, well, I agree with you and support it. In adopting that position, we had over several months spent a lot of time trying to understand what she might have wanted by, as I try to get inside her mind and her values, her beliefs and her wishes. But we had also spent time with the doctors, various specialities, physicians, neurologists, palliative care specialists, quizzing them and cross-examining them, as it were, sort of pushing them to clarify their medical advice. We had obtained an independent medical opinion from somebody outside the hospital who was a specialist, and we had at the same time talked to Catholic ethicists, as well as I say, in terms of understanding her views and values, very many members of the family, friends, work colleagues, that sort of thing.
She was a strong Catholic. What was the advice given to you by the Catholic ethicists?
Two Catholic ethicists, once they were given the details of her medical condition, both formed the view that within the principles or the policy of the Catholic Church, this was a situation in which it was appropriate to stop feeding. And I think that's an important point, because they were the two who actually knew what the clinical information was, that this was a terminal condition in which the food was not being absorbed.
Of course, there was earlier this year the case of Terry Schiavo in the USA. Was the Maria Korp situation similar or analogous?
Not really at all. Terry Schiavo was somebody who had for, I think, 15 years been kept in a stable condition and was comparatively healthy. Mrs. Korp was never, and I need to emphasise that, never in a stable condition. She was declining. She had significant wounds that wouldn't heal. She had significant medical problems. A number of her organs were starting to not function in the way that they should. And so you can't draw a comparison with Terry Schiavo.
Now, of course, the family situation here is very complicated, but did you make a decision in consultation with the family? And I mean, I suppose, namely, by this I mean Maria's daughter, Laura.
Yes, more than that, and also, indeed, with her husband. Prior to making the decision, he was given fairly detailed information via his lawyers about the medical condition and given an opportunity to comment. Yes, so there was a process of consultation.
Of course, it is complicated by the fact that her husband, Joe, who's facing charges for attempted murder,
mm-hmm.
and these could now be upped to murder now that Maria Korp has passed away, he didn't want the treatment to cease.
Well, I'm not sure. I think it's up for him to make statements about what he did or didn't want. Certainly, initially, his lawyers made statements to that effect. I think ultimately he was quoted in the media as saying that he was very happy with the decision that we had made.
In your role as guardian, you allowed the husband to visit the hospital and pay his last respects when it became clear that she was nearing the end. Why did you do that?
Well, that was a decision that I had to make in the best interests of Mrs. Korp. And in making that decision, it was important to try and understand what she might have wanted. And I had evidence to indicate that she wanted to try and keep the marriage together. I had evidence that she was a strong Catholic, and therefore I had assumptions that I drew from that, that compassion and forgiveness would be part of her thinking. And also I had to take into account that there's a presumption of innocence, and if I thought it was in her best interest for other members of the family to visit, it was difficult to see why, for all of these factors, I should exclude him.
Was this for you personally a difficult decision to make?
Oh, exceedingly so. In very many respects, including the emotional respects. On the other hand, I have to say that because our process was so thorough, by the time we came to making that decision, we really had overwhelmingly strong evidence. And to that extent, it wasn't technically a difficult decision, but it was nonetheless, as a human being, as an emotional situation, a very difficult decision.
It's a painful life and death decision.
Yes, painful for everybody involved, not the least, of course, Mrs. Korp, but her family and myself.
There has been, from some quarters, criticism of your decision. I mean, you've been called by one person the public executioner and criticised for not protecting those your office is designed to protect, namely the frail.
Well, I mean, I think those comments are rather sad, because to use those sorts of expressions might sell newspapers or radio programmes, but I don't think it helps in an informed debate. I think if somebody were in possession of the actual facts about her medical condition, they would draw different conclusions. And I do believe in this case that we did protect somebody with a disability, because we were able to stand aside and not have a conflict of interest, not be overborne by emotions or some of these very virulent comments that are made that might in the end push decision-making into a situation where you looked after your own skin rather than hers. It would have been far easier for me to make a decision to simply keep her alive. But I'm not here to make decisions in my best interests, I'm here to make a decision in hers.
Julian Gardner, the Victorian Public Advocate. I'm Damien Carrick and you're listening to The Law Report on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, and now also available for download onto your MP3 player. Today we're looking at just some of the multitude of legal and ethical issues surrounding the death last Friday of Melbourne woman Maria Korp. As we've heard, following the assault in February, Maria's daughter Laura was given control of her mother's financial affairs, and the public advocate was given the power to make life and death decisions about medical treatment. But there is one power that the law deems just too important to ever delegate, the power to change a will. While Maria was in a coma, Maria and Laura's solicitor, Jim Robinson, went to the Supreme Court to remove Joe Korp as a beneficiary of Maria's estate. Associate Professor Prue Vines explains.
Well, it actually can only be done in a few Australian states, and Victoria is one of them. In these states, when somebody lacks capacity, that is, you know, they don't have the knowledge and the understanding of their estate or the surroundings and so on, there's actually a provision in the Wills Act which allows the court to be asked to make a will for them. And this is obviously not a very commonly used provision, but this kind of situation is, I guess, exactly the kind of situation where you might want to use it.
So what was the court asked to do when the daughter of Maria Korp came and requested that the will be changed?
Well, as I understand it, they were asked to write the will in such a way that Mr. Korp was no longer a beneficiary. And what they would do normally is that the court would be asked to make a will for the client, and they normally are asked to make the testes what the client would do if the client were lucid at the time. Actually, the court is trying to stand in the shoes of the person and make the best will that they can for that person.
It's an interesting question, though, because it's hard to know exactly what Maria Korp might have decided if she was lucid at the time and had been confronted with the facts as they're understood. I mean, it's possible that Joe Korp might look her straight in the eye and say, honey, I didn't do it.
Yes, I know. It's very difficult. Clearly, the court has had to look at the issues to do with whether or not there is an attempted murder or a murder. They must be taking that into account. It seems that they must have accepted that there is an issue with Mr. Korp and that he should no longer be regarded as a person who should be the object of Mrs. Korp's bounty.
Of course, we're only talking at this stage about allegations. You know, he hasn't been found guilty by a court and he hasn't pleaded guilty. So there are only charges. There's no finding of guilt.
No, that's right, and it is difficult, but in the similar area of forfeiture, which occurs after somebody has died and where somebody wants to argue that a person killed the person or in some way and therefore they shouldn't get a benefit, in that case you don't always have to wait for the criminal charges to go as far as conviction because you're actually in the civil court, and certainly at least in theory you are entitled to consider all this with the civil standard of proof and in the civil court as a completely separate issue.
In other words, you make some kind of determination on the balance of probabilities, which is a civil test, as opposed to beyond reasonable doubt, which is a criminal test.
Well, exactly. And of course, the case everybody knows where that was done was the O.J. Simpson case.
The Korp case, it certainly grabbed the headlines, but there's been another somewhat analogous case in New South Wales a year or so ago, which also grabbed the headlines, wasn't there?
Oh, yes, the Gonzalez case, which was also a very controversial and well-known case where a son was alleged to have murdered his parents and his sister. And after they died, obviously, he requested money from the estate in order to pay for his trial, the trial being a trial for murder. And what he was trying to do was ask the court to modify the forfeiture rule and allow him access to the funds.
And I understand that the judge said in that case, as a matter of public policy, we're not going to put aside proceeds of the will for your benefit because you're currently facing murder charges.
Well, that's right. They did say that. We won't. And they said, we'll wait until after this has been determined, which is interesting because in principle it seems as if they might not have to wait before they determine this. But in this case, they appear to have decided that they should not allow him to have the money from the estate, and that it was only if he was later not found guilty that he might be able to get the forfeiture rule modified. But in fact, he was found guilty.
And I think he's now serving three concurrent life sentences, I understand.
Mm.
Now, that begs the question, what would happen to Joe Corp if he goes to trial and is found not guilty? Can he turn around and say, well, hey guys, I'm entitled to be the beneficiary of this will, even though you've gone ahead and changed it?
I think the will would probably stand, and he might be then entitled to bring an action under family provision. So he might still get a benefit under the estate if that happened.
But he can't actually reverse the recent finding of the Supreme Court removing him as beneficiary from the will.
No, I don't know of any case where that has happened, and there's certainly nothing in the statute which would suggest that that can happen.
Now, we've been talking about cases where there's been no conviction in a criminal court. But if there is a conviction in a criminal court, then I guess the general principle, the general common sense principle is, well, obviously somebody who has a conviction against them for the death of someone shouldn't benefit from that death financially. But is it always a black and white issue?
No, there are a lot of cases which raise real issues about how this should be dealt with. There are some cases which say we should just apply this as a strict rule, but there have been other cases where people who have killed somebody, the courts have declined to apply the forfeiture rule. And some of those cases have been cases where there's been long-standing domestic violence before the killing occurred, or the easiest cases are the ones where somebody has been regarded as of diminished responsibility, and therefore what they've done has not amounted to murder, and so the courts have been happier to modify the forfeiture rule.
As I understand it, there have been some really interesting cases involving, say, things like mercy killing of a spouse who was suffering from a painful terminal disease, and even though there was a conviction, it was felt that there should be grounds for the forfeiture rule not to apply.
Well, there have been cases like that. One case that's particularly interesting is a case which was actually a suicide pact. This is a Freedom from Hunger case where a husband and a wife had a suicide pact. In this case, actually, both of them died. He killed her. She had a terminal illness. He assisted her suicide, and then he died. And there's a question about whether his estate would be allowed to intervene between her and other beneficiaries. In that case, the court took the view that what we were really interested in was what the intention of the killer was. That is, was the killer aiming to get unjust enrichment from killing them, or was it something completely different? And that same reasoning about what the reasoning for the death and the level of culpability of the killer has also been important in some of the domestic violent cases. So, for example, in Evans' case, the court refused to apply the rule to a woman who'd killed her husband after he'd assaulted her six-year-old daughter, then beaten her, then he loaded a shotgun, whereupon she grabbed the shotgun and killed him. So in that case, it wasn't applied to her.
And I imagine that there might be issues, say, in dangerous driving where you have, say, a long, happy marriage, then the husband gets drunk, gets behind the steering wheel and kills his partner. Yes, of course, it's criminal behaviour, but perhaps it's different from a calculated killing designed to benefit him financially.
Yeah, and these cases are the ones that really bring into relief this very strictness of the rule at common law, because the common law simply says generally if somebody feloniously kills someone that they won't be able to get anything from that person's estate. And for that reason, New South Wales and the ACT both have an act which allows the Supreme Court to modify the rule as long as the killing doesn't amount to murder.
So if you have, say, manslaughter, dangerous driving, what have you, there would still be the possibility that the forfeiture rule might not be applied.
That's right. Yeah, so it makes it a lot easier with those sort of cases, and the court doesn't have to go through the process of trying to work out whether somebody is trying to be unjustly enriched or not and so on. And unfortunately, that particular scenario where, for example, husband and wife are in a car accident and the passenger is killed is relatively common.
Wills expert, Associate Professor Prue Vines from the University of New South Wales. I'm Damien Carrick and you're listening to The Law Report on ABC Radio National. Before Maria died, prosecutors felt that they had enough evidence to charge Joe Corp with attempted murder. the allegation being that Tanya attacked Maria under Joe's instructions. But now that Maria is dead, can that charge be amended to murder? Would this be possible given that the attack took place 6 months ago and that the death followed a decision to withdraw life support? Senior lecturer Peter Rush is an expert in criminal law at the University of Melbourne. He says there have been cases dealing with similar issues in the past.
It's always possible to amend charges before trial. The question is primarily whether or not there is a need for extra evidence to support the shift from attempted murder to murder. That evidence will largely be relating to the mode of death in hospital, and in legal terms, that would be largely addressing the questions of causation, largely. That is, the link between the actions of Jo Corp and her eventual death. Between the actions of Jo Corp and the death of Maria Corp, his wife, there have been a range of other actors taking place. And the question then becomes, what relevance do the intervening actors have in relation to the question of Jo Corp's criminal liability? But the focus, I would want to emphasise that the courts have always insisted that the focus has to be on the criminal liability of Jo Corp, not on really asking, is this other person, such as a doctor or the public advocate, or, and there are a range of other cases where doctors or public advocates are not these third parties, whether they are the actual cause of death.
Well, let's talk briefly about some of the other cases. There has been, I think it's the Royale case, which is the main one. Tell me briefly, what were the facts in that case?
The event in the Royale case is one involving domestic violence and a separation between two partners. The two people were sharing a flat together. The girlfriend walks out of Royale's flat, and that's the separation. She comes back one day to collect some clothes that have been left in the flat. Largely what's going on is that there's threatening behaviour on the part of the boyfriend. She is in the bathroom. She locks herself in the bathroom. She's afraid for her life. And at this point, there is either he throws her out of the window, or she is standing near the window and in fear trips out and falls out of the window, or else she actually jumps out of the window and falls to her death. The question then becomes whether or not either her actions interrupt the causal link between his threatening behaviour and her death.
What did the court decide?
The court decided that it was on appeal, it went all the way up to the High Court, and the court decided it was reasonable for the jury to actually sheet home causal responsibility to the accused, the boyfriend in this instance.
There has been a really interesting case, I think, here in Victoria, which goes to this question of intervening acts, and I guess by medical practitioners. Tell me about that case.
Okay. The case, Evans and Gardner, number 2, it's from 1976. And here what had happened was the accused was a prisoner in Pentridge, the victim was a prisoner in Pentridge, they got into a fight. The accused stabs the victim. He's attended to by prison doctors and he seems to recover, at least seemingly so. 9 months later, however, he is complaining of abdominal pains. He is seen by several doctors, both in the local community and in the prison. And after several meetings with several different doctors, the final doctor recommends that the victim needs in-depth medical examination to determine what's wrong. The prison governor at the time makes a decision that the prisoner is in effect faking it or shirking the situation and doesn't order an in-depth medical examination. That night, the victim dies, and then the question then becomes is, can the accused nevertheless be held responsible for the death of the victim some 9 months later after apparent recovery, given that both doctors had failed to diagnose what was determined later to be a bowel obstruction, and secondly the governor's non-pursuit of medical advice, let's say, put it that way.
And the bowel obstruction was caused by the initial injury?
The bowel obstruction was at the site of the initial wound, internal site of the wound, and was a common result of wounds, stab wounds.
What did the court decide?
Court decided that the question was not whether or not the misdiagnosis of the doctors was the cause of death. Rather, the question was, did the accused substantially cause, in fact, the death? And it was basically, they upheld the decision that, yes, that was sufficient. A jury could reasonably decide that causation had been established given the evidence.
In other words, a murder or manslaughter charge could be sustained.
That's correct.
In this case, extrapolating from that case, with the case of Maria Korp, there's no allegation of misdiagnosis or negligence on behalf of treating doctors. So presumably the case that you're talking about would support the idea that charges could be elevated.
Yes. Most of the causation, not just Evans and Gardner's case, but most of the causation would support that you could actually elevate it from an attempted murder to murder. And the elevation is as a result of the fact that causation is really the only question left. If the prosecutors have already decided attempted murder, then they've already decided that they've got enough evidence to at least make a case in relation to the mental state of the accused, either an intention to kill or cause grievous bodily harm. That is the same mental case, whether it's attempted murder or murder. The only question that would vary between, in this instance, between attempted murder and murder is whether or not you could actually have enough evidence to support the causation claim, part of your case.
Dr. Peter Rush, Senior Lecturer in Criminal Law at the University of Melbourne, talking about the Maria Korp case, a tragedy that's captured the public imagination and generated an enormous amount of media attention. That media coverage has itself become yet another reason for the Korp family to head back to court. While she was still alive, Maria Korp and her daughter Laura commenced a civil action against a number of media outlets for publishing bedside photos of the ailing Maria. Family lawyer Jim Robinson again.
The photographs were taken by other members of the family who are also defendants in the writ in circumstances where Laura understood that they were only to be showed to Maria when she woke up. This was in the very early days when it was hoped that Maria would recover.
Essentially photos of Maria in hospital.
Maria and Laura in hospital. And rather than doing that, the photographs were then taken to Channel 7, which paid some money for it, we believe, although we don't know how much. And Channel 7 has published them on the television several times and also sold them the right to show them to some of the other channels. They've seen them on Channel 9 and I think on Sky, and also to the Herald Sun. The Herald Sun published them on the front page of one of its newspapers in February, including a statement that these photographs were taken with the consent of the family. And that whole process was very offensive to the plaintiffs, and we wrote to the paper and Channel 7 asking that they cease publishing the photographs. They wouldn't do that, so now we've taken proceedings.
And your argument would be that in fact the photos were not taken with the permission of Maria?
Well, they were taken with the permission, but not for that purpose, not for the purpose of being shown to the media. I mean, it is not normally permitted to show photographs of people in that condition unless they give a meaningful consent. These photographs were taken, we say, in confidential circumstances, and it was a breach of that confidentiality to publish them in the newspaper.
It's your understanding that if there was payment made, that that payment went to the person who took the photographer, who I understand is Joe's brother, as opposed to, of course, Laura or Maria.
That's correct.
Lawyer Jim Robinson, a partner with Best Hooper in Melbourne. That's the Law Report for this week. Don't forget, transcripts of the program and audio on demand are available at the ABC website at abc.net.au/rn. And iPod users will be pleased to know the Law Report is now also available for downloading from our website. A big thank you to producer Anita Barrow, and also big thanks to technical producer this week, Chris Lawson. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next week with more law.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs broadcast on more than 260 transmitters, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. live streaming on the net, as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcasts.